Welcome to Patients at Risk, a discussion of the dangers that patients face when physicians are replaced with non-physician practitioners. I'm Dr. Rebecca Bernard, your host and the co-author of the book Patients at Risk. Today, you are listening to part two of my discussion with orthopedic surgeon and former legislator for the state of Missouri, Dr. Keith Frederick, and we're discussing the role of the assistant physician, which is a relatively new designation that Dr. Frederick helped to establish in the state of Missouri for the first time, but it's actually been extended to many other states now, and other states are considering such legislation. The idea of the assistant physician role is that there are not enough residency positions for all graduates or applicants. And without doing a residency, medical school graduates cannot obtain a license to practice medicine. So essentially, there are thousands of well-qualified medical school graduates that cannot continue on to practice medicine. Dr. Frederick thought that this was an important way to help fill the physician shortage, so he created legislation in Missouri that allowed a licensure designation for these graduates to work under the supervision of a licensed physician. Today, Dr. Frederick is meeting someone who directly benefited from this legislation, Dr. Liz Troilo, and she will share her experience with working as an assistant physician. We will also discuss some additional aspects of the legislation and maybe a controversial topic of whether the assistant physician should be able to transition into independent practice. Well, it's a really exciting introduction, I think, because Dr. Frederick, you are one of the main people responsible for the creation of this assistant physician role. And Dr. Troilo, Liz, she became an assistant physician and then did residency, correct, Liz?
Yes.
So, in fact, why don't you tell your story?
I went to Ross in the Caribbean for medical school, and it's a little bit different than the U.S. programs. They kind of start multiple times a year, so it's pretty easy to get off cycle. So I was off cycle. I graduated, but then I needed a year to match. So I am from the Kansas City area, and I found out about it. And I found there's a website called residentswap.org, and a small community in Nevada in Missouri. There's Dr. Jennifer Conley there, who is a huge advocate for the assistant physician position when it kind of came out, and she was one of the first to look for and try and hire. So I was very persistent and called them every day for like 2 weeks and got the job. Just to clarify, she had more than 2,000 applicants for that first AP position. So it was a very popular straight off the bat. And it was the most amazing experience. I'd never really done any rural medicine before. I hadn't even thought about family medicine, honestly. And wanted to specialize a little bit more, ended up doing critical access, all of the things. She is clinic, she goes to nursing homes, delivers babies, does C-sections. So I got to kind of experience exactly what it means to be a rural family medicine doc. I ended up matching at my number one program, Dream University of Kansas Family Medicine, did my 3 years, and then actually signed to work in critical access, full scope, in rural Kansas because of it too.
Wow. What a success story. Dr. Frederick, how do you feel when you hear this? This is huge.
I'll tell you, it's terrific. I've never really discussed this or even thought about it in the context of the AP legislation and efforts. But back when I was applying to med school, I first was a pharmacist, and I applied to med school and didn't get in. So I went to graduate school. That was my sixth year because pharmacy school was 5 years at that time. But to try to strengthen my application, I wrote to a bunch of rural doctors in Missouri and asked them if I could just come and observe. So it was kind of a precursor to this idea of assistant physician. Of course, I wasn't compensated, but he just kind of let me hang around, you know. And I wrote a paper on it called The Observation and Study of a Rural Medical Practice, and submitted that along with my application the next time, and I got in the next time. So it's interesting. I never thought of it in those contexts, but that is a real success story. It's the type of thing that we had hoped would occur. So it's congratulations and glad it worked out.
I'm hoping that we'll see more states take this on right now. It started in Missouri, was the first state, and we are seeing the similar legislation, a little different, but similar idea in Arkansas, Kansas, Utah, Arizona, Louisiana, and Idaho. And then also the state of Washington recently enacted a program, but just for international medical graduates.
I think Tennessee did a similar thing to Washington.
Yeah. I wrote something for the legislative body for them. Yeah.
Just seeing the fruition of your work here is just, it's really amazing.
Really thankful that was the opportunity was given. I'm thankful to the mentors because I know it took a lot of effort and time for those who not only helped create this program, but also are kind of sustaining it right now. Like I mentioned earlier, they aren't getting reimbursed for certain populations. So for them, they're kind of eating those costs, but it's kind of like teaching. It's teaching medical students. You're doing it for the love of teaching and to further our profession. I really hope that we continue expanding it because I agree. There's unfortunately sometimes a thought that if someone didn't match, it was because there was something wrong with that person. And that thought process has come across quite often. And, you know, I know plenty of people that didn't match the first time and have matched since, having kind of networked through the AP folks. And, you know, There was nothing wrong with them. Like you said, they just did not have enough positions, and they're great physicians now. So in fact, I'm a medical director and I work with multiple doctors, and half of them did not match the first time around, and worked in retail, and they didn't have the opportunity to do these things and support their family as well. But now they're great physicians, and we just need to be able to help our own, I think, in this situation. So, and the knowledge is there, the experience is there. We just guide them along.
There's some growing interest too. I know that the concept is endorsed by the Heritage Foundation. Yeah. And also Cato Institute. And in fact, Cato has invited me to participate in a forum at their annual meeting. I think it's in San Antonio in January. So there is interest. There's still, still a possibility that we'll get that Medicare reimbursement and more states then will realize the value of it.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much. Yeah, it's just a simple numbers game. You have more medical students than you have residency spots, but you can't practice medicine until you complete a residency. So that is the thrust of the problem. More residency slots definitely needed, but the AP program is such a great way of helping to get some of these well-qualified medical graduates to be able to care for our patients who desperately need care.
I mention another aspect of this that we haven't touched on yet?
Yes.
This is a concept I call Earn While You Learn. It is a proposal, and it is not contained in the legislation. It would require more work. But the idea of turning this into an alternative pathway for full licensure. Now, my daughter and son-in-law, both are family practice docs that went through the three-year residency here in Missouri. And I wouldn't want to in any way diminish that accomplishment, which is, as you know, grueling and requires a high degree of commitment and sacrifice. But if individuals in an AP program chose to go through a pathway or a program that would have structured didactic sessions, and the analogy I'll use is what's called ECHO, an Enhanced Community Health Outreach. It is a method of a hub and spoke distribution of information that was pioneered in New Mexico to teach family docs how to handle hepatitis, I believe it was, out on Indian reservations. And there's a lot of different ways that it's used now, but Missouri has that infrastructure. And so it would involve their mastering the basic tenets of whatever program they're going through. Let's say it is family practice, but I'd like to see it available for others, not other specialties, but perhaps psychiatry. But at any rate, they would have to demonstrate mastery of that material through benchmark exams. And it would have to take, in my view, a minimum of 5 years. You can't go through in this program what you go through in a three-year structured program for family medicine. But I think offering another alternative way to get fully licensed is a viable idea. And you just have to make sure that they mastered the information and gained the skills needed. So folks that are involved in medical education would have to be involved in this to implement a program that would make sure all those things happen. But that's a way to actually develop more training slots without more funding. Because if they get reimbursement for their services they're providing under the supervision of a physician, then they're able to make a salary. So Medicare doesn't have to come in and underwrite the cost of the residency. So it's really a potential win-win that an individual can take care of patients, they can bill for those services, but at the same time, they're learning under the tutelage of a licensed physician.
I like the standardization aspect of it. I mean, of course, nobody wants to see us return to a pre-Flexner medical education system or an apprenticeship system where we don't have really clear benchmarks and standards. I guess my question would be, who would administer those evaluations, and would that be overseen by any particular body?
I think it would depend. It would fall to the state legislature to establish those protocols. And if the value to the state is so great as it would be in this situation, I would hope that they would devote the resources to simply facilitate it. In the grand scheme of things, it would be a small cost to actually administer all that, because you don't have to provide the salary to the residents.
Which is a huge factor. Now, Dr. Troilo, having done the AP and then finishing your residency, what are your thoughts when you think about an alternate residency pathway?
So I think for, like you said, 3 years of intensive program for anybody is very difficult. But I think we touched a little bit about mental health. And I think if we provided that structured education, and I agree, nothing going back to pre-Flexner, but that structured, possibly testing administered also by USMLE, and it's a longer period. So, you know, you can work, you can possibly have a family, you can possibly do all the things that, you know, we sacrifice in medical education, especially with women. You know, we, you know, kind of push off having families and things for a long time. And if that can be done in a, again, very structured manner, it's a great idea. I always worry that, you know, we worry about others talking about, oh, well, I got these hours signed off on. And, you know, those things are what worries me. But if we can come up with something that is very, like you take NVMEs every other month, you take standardized tests as frequently as possible, but making sure everybody's on the same page, we can, I think that's a great idea.
When you say signing off on hours, you're referring to preceptorship. So it would be really critical that you have very, very well qualified preceptors that were committed to these trainees.
Yes. So, and it also depends on, you know, you brought up psychiatry, depends on what we're looking at. So for, it would be important that the mentors or the people that they're signing off with also are physicians who are practicing within the same specialty, making sure that, you know, there aren't any, you know, nurse practitioners or PAs within the office who are also kind of supervising. You know, they're very kind of almost like ACGME rules, kind of applied in just a longer stretch out period would probably be ideal.
Dr. Frederick, do you have thoughts on the feasibility of that? Would that possibly look like some kind of funding for preceptors, or how would you envision that working out?
Well, with the sort of earn while you learn idea of it, that you do have some cash coming into the practice. I mean, I think that could be developed by the folks that would be the innovators, the ones that would be the trailblazers. And I don't think there's anything wrong with a trainer, say you or my daughter as a family medicine physician, having some compensation for dedicating a certain part of their day every day to teaching this individual. The other thing I'd like to point out, though, is a lot of it could be didactic online. And it's basically this ECHO program that I mentioned is kind of like a just a juiced up Zoom program, really, where it could be like grand rounds at one of our major tertiary care institutions, where whatever the topic of the day is, you have six or eight remote sites logged in, and they listen to the grand rounds, and then they have the opportunity to present a case themselves and to answer questions. And that could be, it could be an hour or two a day. It could be longer than that. I mean, you could basically tailor make it to what the needs were for the students or residents that were in the program. So that could take a big chunk of it. And the training physician wouldn't have to be present for those sessions, but then for the practical experience, seeing patients together, they could be collaborating in that way. And I don't think there's anything wrong with the individual who's doing the training getting a little compensation for it.
Yeah, it's just like being a faculty member at a residency program. And it's so interesting, as you're talking about this, I'm thinking about, thinking back to my residency, I'm thinking about perhaps some of the months that I maybe didn't need to be doing certain electives. You know, I like the idea of having more flexibility. And most medical students, I would say, are self-starters and really just need the direction. And then again, the place to practice. If you tell them to read up on something, they're going to come back and they're going to have read up on something. So that is one of the big advantages to having more flexibility. You know, I have residents that rotate with me, and lately I've been getting a lot of them that keep telling me that they're thinking about doing a fellowship. And I'm like, well, you know, why? I want to do a hospice fellowship, or I want to do a sports medicine fellowship. And I'm kind of like the opinion of learn while you earn. I'm like, you know, you could just get a job as a family, these are family physicians, get a job as a family doctor and study sports medicine and study hospice and get a side job like I did moonlighting at hospice and get a mentor. Like, you don't need to, you know, I don't know if it's like this fear of going out into the real world, but I agree with you. I think there's a lot of learning that you can do on the job if you have the background and the fundamentals.
Well, I'll throw it to our listeners. What do you think about the creation of a pathway for licensure for assistant physicians? It'd be an interesting discussion. So send me an email through the contact link at patientsatrisk.com. And if you'd like to come on the podcast to discuss this topic or really any other topic, please send me a message. I'd love to have you on to discuss any nuance that pertains to physician shortages and ways to ensure that patients have access to physician-led care. Thanks so much for listening. Of course, I encourage everyone to check out my books, Patients at Risk, which I co-authored with Dr. Naran Alajba, and my follow-up book, Imposter Doctors, Patients at Risk. You can get either of those, or both of them, at Amazon or at barnesandnoble.com. I definitely recommend that you consider the Kindle edition because it has direct hyperlinks to the 999 citations that we have in the books. If you're a physician and you'd like to advocate for the mission of physician-led care for all patients and truth and transparency among healthcare practitioners, please join our group. It's called Physicians for Patient Protection. Our website is physiciansforpatientprotection.org. Thanks again for listening, and we'll see you on the next podcast.